Hello, I'm Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine, and this is Philosophy Now radio show, and today we're talking about the tragedy of life. To discuss the tragedy of life and some responses to it some modern deep thinkers have recommended, I have with me Christopher Hamilton and Simon May from King's College London, and Ken James from Birkbeck College and the College of the New Humanities. Did I pronounce that right,
New
Ken?
College of the Humanities.
Yeah, okay. So to kick things off, I just want to start by asking Christopher Hamilton, what is the tragedy of life? Is it that whatever we do, we can't stop bad things happening? Or is there more to tragedy than that?
Well, actually, yes, I think there is more to tragedy than that. I mean, to start, one might say that there are probably three ways of approaching the notion of tragedy. Uh-huh. One would be through the idea of the tragic theatre, as we talk about Greek tragic theatre and Shakespeare's tragedies. The other is the notion that you alluded to, the idea that tragedy is something which is really bad, as when we say the child was knocked over by a car and that was an absolute tragedy. And then there's a third way of thinking about tragedy, which is in fact the way that interests me most as a philosopher, and that's the idea of a tragic view of life.
Yeah.
And one way, I think, to think about that is in terms of the idea of a moral world order, or more exactly, the absence thereof.
Uh-huh.
So if you think, for example, about the idea of... if you think about the idea of moral goodness, one of the things that seems to me true about life is that the wicked often flourish, that the good go to the wall, that there is in fact no final accounting of happiness with respect to virtue and punishment with respect to wickedness. And that's a view, I think, that Christianity, at least in its mainstream form, denies, that there's a teleology, that this world is such that...
Sorry, teleology.
There's an end goal to human history. Right. Essentially, and there's an end goal to each human life, and what that means is essentially that even if we can't see it here and now, in the overall structure of things, the good will be rewarded and the bad will be punished, and in that sense happiness and virtue come together, and punishment and wickedness come together.
But that's a fiction, and you think that the tragedy of, if I can summarise, the tragedy of life is that morality is not connected with anything that actually happens in life.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I would say that it's only tangentially connected with the notion of happiness. Right. A great many philosophers have wanted to say, and there's still plenty of philosophers saying this now, wanting to try and show that fundamentally that the good life, the morally good life and the happy life coincide pretty much. I mean, obviously, there are complications in the arguments. And that seems to me not true. It seems to me that these things, they overlap, of course, to some extent. Uh-huh. But I think basically they come apart. And I think that looked at from one point of view, is tragic, because we have the desire for justice, that the world be a just place, and we have a desire that things make sense, that and that our own individual investment in moral goodness is not, you know, a form of foolishness, for example. So I think that one way to look at that is as part of the tragedy of life, or something that makes life tragic.
Okay, Ken and Simon, how would you respond to that? I mean, you're both interested in tragedy, I mean, but do you have the same sort of understanding of the tragic as Christopher?
Well go on, Ken.
I wanted to take up one of the points just made and say that I'm developing Christopher's point in that one way to look at tragedy is what is really tragic, perhaps, in life is a certain fundamental lack of meaning. Uh-huh. And I think Nietzsche captured this very well. So I'm going to quote from the third essay, The Genealogy of Morals, because a lot of people think, oh, the problem of life is suffering. That's what his predecessor Schopenhauer had said. And Nietzsche has this very incisive reply to Schopenhauer's point about the ubiquity of suffering and the unavoidability of suffering. He said, "Man did not know how to justify, explain, affirm himself. He suffered from the problem of his meaning. He suffered otherwise as ill. He was, for the most part, a diseased animal. But the suffering itself was not his problem. Rather, that the answer was missing to the scream of his question, to what end suffering? Man, the bravest of animals and the one most accustomed to suffering, does not negate suffering. He wants it. He even seeks it out, provided one shows him a meaning for it, to this end of suffering. The meaninglessness of suffering, not suffering itself, was a curse that has thus far stretched over man, over humanity." And I think that's a really deep point of Nietzsche's, that, you know, we often tend to think, oh, the tragedy of life is that man inevitably suffers. Right. That was a line that Schopenhauer in particular took. And Nietzsche says, no, suffering is not really the fundamental problem. Suffering is bearable. What we are as humans is we're fundamentally animals, and what makes us separate from the actual animals is that we look for meaning. Uh-huh. And the deep void of not having meaning is what can be truly tragic in life. Mm. And I just think I'm developing the theme that Christopher started on.
Thanks, Ken. What about you, Simon? What's your view on tragedy?
Well, I think tragedy is absolutely inevitable. I mean, life is tragic.
Well, what would you say is tragedy?
I'm just about to say. In the sense that our deepest desires and values necessarily conflict either with each other, in which case, in the sense that they are in principle incompatible with each other, or with the world in which they find themselves. So, you know, one is a matter of principle and the other is a matter of practice. And I think that is absolutely inevitable. And tragedy is the inevitable conflict of what we most deeply hold, either with other things we most deeply hold, or with the world as we find it. So one example would be the Romeo and Juliet situation of encounter with the world as we find it, in which the deep love of two young people for each other comes up against a social prohibition against two rival families' offspring being united in a love match, and that's why we call that a tragedy.
So it's a clash of expectations. Would that be a good
summary? Well, expectations is putting it a little weakly. Yeah. It's really a clash of our deepest values, and perhaps there's nothing more ultimate than the desire for life and the reality of death. So, for example, that would be one reason why I would say life is inevitably tragic. I mean, the desire for life, I think, is something innate to every living being. And death is also something innate to every... And it's quite obvious that those two things, at the limit, conflict.
Okay. Christopher, do you want to respond to anything?
Yeah, well, I want to respond partly to what Ken said, because I agree entirely. But just to add something on top of that, which is, in my view, and I think this is also a thought that's in Nietzsche, is that whatever else Christianity did, it gave us meaning to suffering. And I think that part of the modern condition, of course, Nietzsche is well known for saying God is dead, in a slightly lurid phrase. But the basic idea is that, for example, that story about suffering, that ultimately there is a meaning to suffering, is mistaken, that we can no longer really believe it. And this is what the process of secularization is. And I think that means that the modern age is particularly ripe for being understood as a tragic age, because it's an age in which we have to face the facts of our suffering in ways... without many of the supports that we've had from traditional metaphysical pictures of the world. And I think, too, I agree with what Simon has said. And again, I think perhaps could develop the point a little bit. One of the things, when I was thinking about this programme, that came to mind was a little book by Samuel Johnson, Rasselas, the Prince of Abyssinia, which is really a story of utopia. Yeah. The prince is living in Happy Valley, and they're having, you know, everything is provided. All of their desires are satisfied. It's a world without conflict. It's a world of peace and so on. But the big problem, as Johnson sees it, is that it's boring, and that's why they want to live and leave. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing that Simon is talking about, that in fact, if all our desires were satisfied, if we lived in a conflict-free world, which is the kind of world we always think we want to live in fact, we would find it boring. So I think that...
Well, you might have desires for exciting things, you know.
You might have desires for exciting things, that's true,
no, but
I
many
think
philosophers
it's...
have said, like Schopenhauer, I mean, Chris is right here, that if our desires are all satisfied, we end up being boring. I mean, they cease to be exciting, you know.
Being boring or being bored, probably both.
Well, I don't know. I think probably desires have got a sort of an infinite capacity for variation and, you know...
Yes, but they're just talking about the theoretical limit of which they are all satisfied. I think this is the utopian situation
and I think
referring to.
Exactly, and I think that it's... And I think that, you know, just to give another example, there's a wonderful short story, a longish short story by Kleist, Heinrich von Kleist, Michael Kohlhaas. And this is an example, it's based on a true story of a man who became completely obsessed with the idea of the pursuit of justice. And this is, of course, a noble and wonderful cause. But in being obsessed with this pursuit of justice, he destroys all those around him, including his wife, and he ends up being punished. Okay. And I think this is crucial, that it's not just that one might have a desire for something bad which conflicts with something else. It's that even our noblest desires can come into conflict with some of our other deepest needs and wishes and so on.
Okay. Simon?
Can I just disagree with both Chris and Ken on one thing, and in fact with Nietzsche, this whole question of of suffering, and the reason why life is tragic is because we need a meaning to suffering. I think This is a very particular symptom of a very particular culture that we live in, one largely influenced by Christianity, but also there are other cultures, Buddhistic cultures share this, in which suffering is given such a disvalue, in which suffering is seen as such a disaster, that unless we give some very powerful meaning to it, life, as it were, isn't worth living. And I think that when Nietzsche says these things, he's actually still very much in his Christian mode. So I don't see it actually as intrinsic to life that suffering is the thing that creates its tragic dimension.
Well, I want to ask you...
I think it only creates this enormous tragic dimension if we regard suffering as so utterly unacceptable. And in fact, later in his life, Nietzsche strove for an acceptance of, or an affirmation, better put, of the world and of suffering that doesn't involve regarding it as such an utter disaster. And he looked to the ancient Greeks for inspiration in finding such an affirmation.
I wanted to ask you, Ken, actually, what would it be to give life... What would it take to give life meaning to suffering?
Well, as Christopher mentioned, Christianity gives meaning to suffering because it gives us redemptive story. You suffer in order to get a reward.
There is a purpose for pain and suffering, so therefore it's okay.
That would be one version of it. Yeah. But I want to develop the points that have been going on between Christopher and Simon.
Sure.
And because I agree with Simon, too, that suffering doesn't have to be seen as tragic. In fact, Nietzsche thought a great life, a good life, involves taking up challenges, and challenges inevitably involve suffering.
Right.
Because if you take great challenges, you're going to fail a lot of the time. So Nietzsche was not one of these philosophers that said, the point of life is to escape suffering. But let me make the converse of that. I want to point out that, in fact, tragedy can move quite apart from these questions of suffering and happiness. And here's an example to put this point forward, that someone could have an extremely happy life and still have a totally tragic life. Let's say an example. It's a possible example, but imagine someone in a coma who during that coma has a certain kind of consciousness and they're having a fantasy life, like a dream that they take to be completely real.
Right.
And they enjoy it tremendously.
Uh-huh.
I still think that looks like a tragic life to me, just because they're just lying there.
Well,
but in some sense, they're content.
Maybe
if they could report, they'd report. They'd say, I'm perfectly content.
Is it the case that you have to ask who's it tragic to or for in that case? I mean, it's tragic for the people watching, but not for the person involved, maybe? Something like that? You wanted to say something, Chris?
Yes, I mean, I wanted to... I mean, when Ken was talking about the possibility of a life that would be a life of contentment but also tragic, I mean, immediately came to mind, Tolstoy in his Confession, where in fact he describes a life of extraordinary success, you know, extraordinarily famous novelist and so on, with a wife who loved him and children, money and so on. And then the bottom falls out of his life. He just has this intense sense of the meaninglessness of things. And there are reasons for that connected with, for example, his brother's death. But I don't think that it's, and I agree with Simon on this, I don't think the suffering that, for example, Tolstoy saw must lead to the notion of a tragic view of life. I think that's absolutely right. But nonetheless, I think it's true that, as a general fact, it does tend to lead in that direction. And I think Nietzsche is actually more complicated than perhaps Simon has suggested, because, of course, Nietzsche thought, that Greek tragic culture was a response to the experience of suffering, amongst other things, and an attempt to make sense of it. So I think he's attributing even to a pre-Christian culture the sense that suffering raises a puzzle. And I think it's true that one doesn't have to be freighted with a whole load of Christian expectations simply to have the thought, why is this happening? And I think that's a big difference, for example, between pleasure and pain. When we experience pleasure, we very rarely, if ever, ask, why is this happening to me? We just take it for what it is, the pleasure that comes to us. Whereas pain is something which immediately raises the question, at least pain beyond the, you know, very small pains, why is this happening? What's the meaning behind this? So I think that Nietzsche is a bit more complicated. I think that suffering doesn't have to lead, or inevitably or necessarily lead, to a tragic view. But I think there's something about it which invites in that direction. And my own reading of Nietzsche is that he will probably accept that.
Well, I mean, I actually already suggested that Nietzsche's complicated, because Ken read the passage in which clearly suffering makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
But then there's also that strand to Nietzsche in which he wishes us to look at the world, look at suffering in the face, and say yes, as he puts it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when Chris talks about Nietzsche's attitude to the ancient Greeks, he's this is much more in his early work, where he's still under the influence of Schopenhauer and is fundamentally a Christian writer, right. Nietzsche himself, as right. he himself says in his attempt at the self-criticism uh-huh. of that very work.
Okay, well, so lots of people would find that unbelievable that Nietzsche was a Christian writer.
Well, Christian in spirit, and uh-huh. in the sense that suffering is such a problem that uh-huh. we need to find a redemptive way out of it. In the sense, there is no higher task right. than finding a redemptive okay. way out of it. Mm. Now, in his earlier work, uh-huh. for example, The Birth of Tragedy, he sees art, the, if you like, illusion or fiction creating activity, okay. as a way of covering up or making good the terrible insights that he attributes to the, you know, to the Dionysian, to the sort of fundamental metaphysical driving force of life.
And that's later like on, your id or something in Freudian terms.
Well, without getting into comparisons, yeah. that is still a fundamentally what we would call in philosophy dualistic view of the world uh-huh. that he inherits from Schopenhauer. Later on, he tries to get away from all that, and he says, I want to be like Dionysus. I just want to look at how things are, and I want to resist, in this sense, I agree with Chris, the natural urge for us inheritors of Christianity, one should uh-huh. add, the natural urge to say, why am I having pain? Why am I having suffering? Mm. And to look at it and to say yes. Now, what saying yes is something we can come to. Yeah. But saying yes, crucially, does not involve a calculation in which we try to figure out what the benefit of the pain is to us. This is the crucial point. Uh-huh. And I think on that, you know, I would part company with what Chris has said.
Okay. Ken, what do you think about Nietzsche's response to tragedy? Do you think it's a viable response to say, yes, I'm going to affirm my suffering?
Well, as I say, it comes down a lot to Nietzsche's reflections on happiness. Uh-huh. And as happiness to Nietzsche was not a matter of contentment. Happiness was, if you like, more nearer to what Aristotle said about realizing your talents. Uh-huh. And so he said, look, you can have a life. Look at Nietzsche's own life. In terms of contentment, practically zero. He was not a very content person. Mm-hmm. He was very lonely. He was wandering up in all these pensions in Sils Maria, etc. Yeah. I can't say it was particularly in terms of contentment as a phenomenological field, raw field, I guess he had very little of it. But we can look at his life. I don't see his life as a tragedy because he achieved his talents, and that's what he right. thought the good life was. That was real happiness. It was not something phenomenological, not contentment. It was taking great challenges and pushing your talent to the limits by facing these challenges and developing them.
So to you, a tragedy for Nietzsche would be somebody not fulfilling their potential.
Yes.
Rather than somebody not being happy.
Not being happy. Well, he'd even disagree about what happiness okay. really is. Sure. But yes, basically, yes. He says, look, I mean, it's also his elitist. He said most people have no potential. It's one of the things that's so hard to take in Nietzsche. But he did think, and Aristotle is more democratic about this. Aristotle wanted, and as did John Stuart Mill, their idea of happiness was as many people as possible, or everyone, reaching their potentials. And it's a tragedy for that potential not to be reached.
Yeah.
Neither Mill nor Aristotle nor Nietzsche thought of happiness in the way we moderns often do, as not being challenged, as feeling content, as something phenomenological.
Yeah, something that makes you thrive, I think. We talked a bit about Nietzsche. What about other philosophers' views on tragedy? Does anybody know any sort of notable tragedians among the philosophical canon? You want to mention like an existentialist or something?
Well, there are of course existentialists, and I mean Camus would be one example of somebody with his idea of the absurdity of life.
Okay, this is Albert Camus, French existentialist, last century.
Yes, I mean his idea of the the absurdity of life is partly. It's partly this Nietzschean idea of the death of God, and what Max Weber, the founding father of sociology, called the idea that the world is entzaubert, that the world is disenchanted.
Right. And what does that mean?
It means that we no longer see the world as through, well, it means many things, but amongst the things it means is that we no longer see the world as through a system of, for example, gods or the god, or a sense that the world is made for us and that we are made for the world, that we're at home in the world, for example. On the contrary, it's the idea that we're just thrown here, we just appear here.
So there's nothing that's going to magically happen that make everything all right.
Absolutely not. And I think Camus is somebody who certainly thought that way. I mean, I think also one of the advantages of Camus' work is that he places a great deal of emphasis too on ordinary, everyday forms of tragedy. So he's very interested, for example, in work and in the banality of work in the modern world, in the way in which people's lives are ground down through their work, not because they're suffering terrible tragedies, but precisely through the ordinary, everyday way of coping with the way the world is. So that's one aspect. Boredom is also another aspect that Camus talks about. And I think Camus actually had a response, partly in the idea of a response to the natural world. There are moments in Camus' writing where he's profoundly responsive to the beauty of the natural world. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in his novel La Peste, The Plague, most of it is pretty bleak, but there is a moment where a couple of the characters go swimming in the sea together, and this is a moment, a kind of idyllic moment for Camus, which says, no, actually that response to the beauty of the natural world is a possibility and is something which one can seek out and as a response, I think, to the tragedy.
Okay, Simon, what about other existentialists like Kierkegaard, for instance, or anyone who might pick... Sartre.
Well, I mean, I suppose I could mention Heidegger, who was very influenced by Kierkegaard, and Sartre is one of his disciples. I mean, I think, you know, Heidegger, perhaps like many of his 20th century
colleagues... So he was a German philosopher the early 20th century.
Yes, the German philosopher who was a member of the Nazi party. And also, I would say, probably like Camus, you know, he had this vision of the human being as thrown, he used the word geworfen, as thrown
into a world
in which is, in a sense, not ready for him, and he's not ready, or she is not ready for it. And the idea is not that this is actually tragic. I mean, in a sense, the idea is perhaps a little bit like that of affirmation that I was sort of groping at for before, which is that it's not actually tragic. It's part of accepting and understanding life that you accept the fact that we are thrown into this world that can be profoundly hostile to our intentions, that has no concern for us whatsoever, and that the challenge of living a well-lived life
to Heidegger
for Heidegger is to find an authentic relationship to this world in which you in a sense make it your own, and in which you in some way dispense with the whole question of, you know, cost benefit calculations, and, you know, beyond this point of
so
cost,
how would one set about making the world one's own world, according to Heidegger?
Firstly by a profound act of acceptance, which also involves getting rid of, I mean, this is a very complicated and long topic, involves getting rid of a sort of means end instrumental approach to the world, gets rid of seeing the world as a sort of object for the subject to manipulate, in fact gets rid of the whole subject object distinction.
So just make yourself at one with the world, sort of thing.
Well, I mean, that would be a bit of the sort of hippie version of Heidegger.
Ken, what about Sigmund Freud? He thought that suffering and unhappiness were inevitable. Would you say that he's a tragic view of life and that his response is a good response?
Freud didn't have Nietzsche's enlightened sense of happiness happiness is achieving your potential. He had a very pedestrian notion of happiness as kind of ordinary contentment. And he thought life was tragic because he said, look, the end result of psychoanalysis is to replace extraordinary unhappiness with ordinary happiness. Ordinary unhappiness, I'm sorry. And so, in that sense, he had a tragic view, but I don't think he had this picture, this wider picture of Nietzsche about... He didn't interrogate happiness in any sophisticated way. He just took happiness to be contentment. But he said, look, it's just not in human nature to be content. So, in some sense, in that shallow sense, he had a tragic view of life. He said, our drives are always going to disrupt us in various ways, and it's always going to lead to this certain kind of discontent.
Do you think he was right?
Putting my hat on philosopher of science, I think it's really interesting what Freud said, and it could all be literally true, could all be just luft, empty air. I just don't know how to test those kinds of claims.
Okay, fair enough. Christopher, you wanted to say
that? Yeah, I wanted to say that I think part of the difficulty, and it comes up, I think, in what Ken has just said, is that, you know, we could speak about the happiness of a life or the contentment of a life or the way in which people flourish or fail to flourish or notions of well-being. And these terms in various ways flow around philosophy. philosophy, uh-huh. and they overlap a bit, but they are quite different. I mean, it would make sense, perfect sense in, to my mind anyway, to say that somebody was flourishing but unhappy. Maybe Nietzsche flourished but was unhappy. And I think that raises another aspect of this idea of when one thinks about whether a life is tragic or not, is that there are different perspectives on it. I mean, I would in fact disagree with Ken and say that I think that at one level, Nietzsche's life was deeply tragic in the sense that he was completely incapable of forming the kinds of friendships and romantic relationships that he wanted to. But from another perspective, of course, Ken is absolutely right that, you know, in terms of the work produced and the influence that he had. And I think one of the things this shows is, and it's not just the case with Nietzsche, it's the case with all of us, that there are so many different perspectives that one could take up on towards a life, that that life could look tragic from one perspective, but from another perspective not be tragic at all. And so I'd be disinclined to say about any given life it was tragic or it wasn't tragic. You know, there are other cases of somebody who, take the case of Primo Levi, an Italian who has spent about a year and a half in Auschwitz, 1943 to 1945. And, you know, there's somebody who suffered in the most unspeakable manner, didn't lose any faith. He had no faith before the camps. He had no faith after. And in a certain way, certainly that part of his life was, in one sense, deeply tragic. But he made something of that life in an incredible way through his writing. Yeah. And so I think one can't say his life either was or wasn't tragic. It depends so much on the terms one brings to bear.
Wasn't it Heidegger that said that you can't really judge a life until really the last second until they're dead?
There's an old Greek notion of call no man happy until he is dead. Okay. And this was partly a Greek idea that, you know, one's life could go very well and then suddenly at the end something terrible would happen.
Okay.
Well, one was no longer happy.
Or even after.
Yes, there's a discussion in Aristotle.
Exactly. We're going to take a break for a track now. This is going to be Suzanne Vega and The Queen and the Soldier, and then we'll come back with some responses to the human condition. Partly, you're listening to the Philosophy Now radio show on Resonance or on a podcast, even perhaps. Today, we're talking about tragedy, the tragic sense of life, and how philosophers have responded to that. I have with me Christopher Hamilton and Simon May from King's College London, and Ken James from Birkbeck, and the new College of the Humanities. So, first, I want to start off by asking Ken, we mentioned different notions of tragedy before. I mean, how does the philosophical notion of tragedy that we've been talking about linked with the dramatic notion that was originated with the Greeks 2,500 years ago?
Right. When Chris began, he mentioned these different notions of tragedy, and basically we've been talking about tragedy in life. So I'd like to talk a bit about tragedy and drama and bring up a particular paradox that Hume brought up.
Scottish philosophy of 18th century, yeah.
Right. Hume's, it's often called the paradox of tragedy, and the basic idea is tragedy is a horrible thing, but why do we enjoy going to see tragedies.
Right.
What's special about that? Various people have brought in various notions like catharsis. That's a $6 million question. I'm going to let Chris say.
Okay. Well, a traditional idea, an idea that goes back at least as far as Aristotle, is that what the tragic theatre does for us is to purge us in some way. And I think, purging would be one way of talking about the notion of catharsis. And the two emotions in particular...
Sorry, let me stop it. Yeah. So it means we go through tragic emotions without actually going through tragedy, and thereby we sort of cleanse our minds.
It's very complicated, but it's something like that. And in particular, Aristotle talks about fear and pity, and his essential idea, I think, is that we, as Ken says, we go to see the tragedy, and in fact, it's a horrific thing, and we experience in some way the emotion of fear, but also pity because we see the tragic protagonist in a state of despair, and. Aristotle, like many later thinkers as well, was puzzled by why do we do this? Why do we go to the theatre? Why do we want to see this? And the answer in terms of this purging is, I suppose, in the end, that in some way it's morally educative, and in some way it fits us better for life. And that actually fits in largely with an ancient Greek view of tragedy, because tragedy, the tragic theatre, was something that was at the centre of the cultural life, particularly of Athens in the 5th century BC.
How does that compare with what Hume would say?
Hume's basic view of tragedy is it's related to that, but it's, in some sense it's simpler in another way, in that we see horrible stuff happening, but at a certain kind of a distance that makes it bearable. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I just want to put that on the board because I want to get to a deeper point. And the point I want to get to is that I think it's another way of looking at what's really going on in tragedy, and it answers Hume's question, and it links the two. That is, it links tragedy in life and tragedy in the theatre. I think all of us have an intimation that our life is somehow tragic. It's got to do with the finitude of life, the contingency of life, which Chris, I think, and Simon will talk about more about shortly, and also the meaninglessness of life, that our life is contingent and perhaps meaningless and doesn't add up to a whole. And I think that is a really big worry, because we only see bits and pieces of our life. We don't see the whole, and we don't know if it adds up.
Okay.
And what's very special about tragedy in the theatre is, in tragedy in the theatre, we see horrible things happening to the protagonist, but in some deep way, it's part of an overall web that is meaningful. And I think part of the enjoyment of tragedy can be there's an intimation that while we can never be in a position to see our life like that, there's a hope that maybe my life is like that. My life is extremely painful, horrible things happen, but the real worry is, and it doesn't add up to anything. And theatre gives you this intimation that it can be part of a wider, meaningful web.
So this is going back to your Nietzsche stuff, is that why we like tragedy is that we get to see the whole picture, or the big picture, whereby the tragedy has meaning in theatre, whereas
yes,
we
it's
don't,
a Nietzschean theory of tragedy, if you like.
Okay, Simon, you look like you want to say something in response.
No, I didn't particularly, but I could just add that there is another way of viewing tragedy, which is not the way Ken articulated all the Aristotelian thing of pity and fear, but that it is a way of... It is a way for each of us, by seeing it on the stage or by listening to a tragic music drama, say like Tristan and Isolde, it's a way of identifying with what life is really about in terms of, for example, this thrownness and so on that I spoke about Heidegger having written on, but without obviously the wrenching pain of ourselves going through it. So it's not that we're just sitting there, you know, having pity for what's going on for the characters and their fates. It's that we're actually ourselves able to participate in these, you know, to identify with these deepest realities of life, but without actually, you know,
so whatever it is,
going through it ourselves.
Whatever it is, it seems to be, it's like it's calling up emotions that in sort of a safe situation, really.
Maybe I could just develop this the point about the Nietzschean view of tragedy, because I think one aspect of it for Nietzsche is to oppose tragedy in the theatre to the notion of morality. And I think one fundamental idea is that in the tragic theatre, take a case like Macbeth. If we were to come across a character like Macbeth, then we'd run a mile or call the police or something. But there in the theatre, we're able to affirm this immense titanic energy of evil. And I think what Nietzsche's thought is that somehow, therefore, I mean, he's not entirely clear on this, it has to be said, but that his thought is somehow that we can affirm that evil in the theatre in a way that we can't quite affirm it in life. But I think actually that my own view about Nietzsche is that that leads him at times to fantasize the idea of being able to affirm that in life and not just in the tragic theatre. So he's often able to, you know, speak about horrendous, awful, morally terrible people as if they were necessary to what he calls, you know, the economy of life. And the truth is, I think that that, if you like, suspension of our moral attitudes in the theatre is just something that we can't do out there in real life. But nonetheless, and picking up on the point that both Ken and Simon have made, the experience of the affirmation of this evil in the theatre is in a certain kind of way liberating, and that might be part of the reason why we go to the tragic theatre.
Okay. So going to the theatre is one response to tragedy, but I mean, as a general philosophical response to the tragedy of life, which ones do you think are the most plausible of what the philosophers have said, or what you think yourselves, I suppose?
Well,
starting with Ken, let's start with Ken.
No, let's start with Chris.
Okay, let's start with Chris.
Well, my view is that I can't answer the question directly because I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I want the answer to be able to laugh at life. I want the answer to be comedy, but I'm not sure how to make that work as an idea.
Ideas that going to work?
Well, they may work in one way. I mean, if actually you think about the writings of Chekhov or you think of the writings of Kafka, they have the surface aura of tragedies, but often they have a highly kind of farcical comedic element in them, and it may be that if somehow one could see oneself as a character in a Chekhov story or play or in a Kafka, then maybe there would be some way of responding to the tragedy of life in that way.
I guess,
I just wanted to add that I think that many philosophical systems, indeed all philosophical systems, aim really to try and say that life makes sense. The different bits and life is a chaos, and
well,
we know
apart
that.
From the nihilistic ones.
Well, the nihilistic ones, no, perhaps not. But all of the grand philosophical systems have the aim to try and show, well, actually, life can be made comprehensible. We can understand how the human condition, and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that this is, in fact, an attempt to deny the facts of our condition, which include, for example, and Ken mentioned this earlier, the contingency of our lives. It seems to me simply true that we're just born without any choice. We have no choice who our parents are, where we're born, the mother tongue that we speak, our early formative experiences. We have no choice over our basic character traits or what we look like. And it seems to me that sheer contingency, when one thinks about it, can be absolutely terrifying. Yeah. And I think a lot of philosophical systems, and certainly Christianity in the mainstream, has tried to say, no, actually, no, this stuff is willed by God, or it makes sense in the system.
Can I just ask Chris a question?
Sure.
Chris, why do you think that's tragic? I mean, not everything that's terrifying is tragic.
No.
And I'd just like to understand what is specifically the tragic dimension in
of
that.
The Sorry, let me clarify that. He wants to know, Simon wants to know, why is the fact of the contingency of our lives, I mean, the sort of randomness of why they're one thing rather than another, I guess.
Which indeed can be terrifying.
Why is that a tragic thing, the fact that, you know...
Right, well, I think the bad reason for it might be that we live in a culture which is moving into a period of post-Christianity, in my view, and the consequence of that is that we come to it with a whole set of expectations about what Christianity could do for us in terms of a system which would make sense of things. And so we suffer, and this is a Nietzschean point, of course, it's absolutely what Nietzsche says, we suffer from the fact that we'd really like there to be a God and the Christian system to make sense, but actually we can't really believe it anymore. I think that's part of it. I think the other part is to come back to some of the things that we've been mentioning earlier, which is that the contingency of our situation means that we all of us have to cope with being the kind of individual that we are, and that's something over which we have very little control, that often exceeds our capacity to understand, that is often a source of great mystery and perplexity. And I think from that point of view, again, it's like suffering. It doesn't necessarily lead to a tragic view, but I think it invites one into a tragic view, that human beings are homeless, that this doesn't make sense. It makes no sense why I am as I am. I just am as I am, and that's just the way things are. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Simon, I remember that you've written in your book on love that the desire for love is a desire to be ontologically rooted. Is that a correct remembrance?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so this sort of seems to connect with this whole tragic theme of needing to be what Christopher's called have an ontological home. So it seems like you're agreeing in this. I mean, do you think that our need to have roots in the world is a sort of tragedy if it's not met, or when it's not met?
Well, yes. I mean, I think part of our so-called tragic condition is, as I said at the beginning, that we have very powerful needs, and one of those is for roots that can never be perfectly met.
Okay.
However, I think that the tragic dimension specifically only becomes unbearable when we have this expectation that these immense needs, you know, like for rootedness, for flourishing and so on, in a sense should be met, but that that they aren't. I mean, that there's some lack of acceptance of the imperfection of the world. And I think Chris is absolutely right in saying that, you know, this stems from a very particular philosophical and religious tradition, which, if we really were to overcome it, right. In other words, if we were really to get over and become post-Christians, which we're anything but, we're sort of Christians now, but without the God. I mean, yeah, just putting it a bit simplistically. But
we've still inherited a Christian sort of metaphysics without
God. We've certainly inherited a lot of the expectations of, you know, having a sort of very powerful set of meanings that can guide and give justification to our lives.
So what's your preferred response to the tragedy of life, then? Simon, yes, Simon.
Well,
out of the philosophers or your own.
Well, I would say, you know, an affirmation of the sort that looks at the world. I mean, I'm not saying that any of us are capable of doing that, but if you ask what would my preferred response be, would be to be able to look at the world and not say yes in the sense of, you know, it's all for the best, but just to say yes in the sense of finding something magnificent in its sheer existence. Now, that might sound vague,
right?
But I think it's a tremendously difficult and important task for us all. I think Chris is absolutely right that he alluded to this, that laughter or comedy is a key to both getting us there, but also it's part of that attitude of acceptance. And, you know, I could talk, for example, I mean, one of the greatest creations ever of a human being is Così fan tutte of Mozart, which many people think is an exceedingly trivial story in which lovers dress up as each other and then seduce their, you know, their friends, boyfriends, and so on. But what is so extraordinary about it is that something that which we would encounter in daily life, we would say, you know, they're despicable and these men have suffered a terrible ordeal. We leave the theatre essentially light-hearted.
Okay.
And the genius of Mozart's music is to bring that state about, and to me that's part of an attitude of acceptance.
So maybe art is a path to salvation from tragedy for you. Okay, Ken, so we've put it off now, but I want to ask you, what is your as a professional philosopher, or even as a layman, what do you think that you've heard the philosophers say that is the most plausible response to the human condition, or that, you know, something that actually works for people who feel life is tragic? What is a good response?
Well, I do like Nietzsche's response to say that tragedy isn't really the problem. Life is irredeemably painful, but there are other vectors of measurement of pain. So we can say, yes, life is tragic, but we can still affirm life. This is why he admired the Greeks so much. He said they had the honesty to admit that life is invariably painful, a lot of your plans are going to go in the cropper, but they could still affirm life. So what Nietzsche said is tragedy isn't the problem, it's what tragedy does to us is the problem. That tragedy makes us passive, tragedy makes us turn away from life. So what Nietzsche was really looking for was someone who could be honest enough to admit the painfulness of life, and also that it's life can be painful in another sense of not achieving your potential, your plans, but still to be able to affirm life and not to take a passive stance and to turn away from it. But I'd like to interject a philosophical joke here to leaven things up. Slightly different take on tragedy, and this is the one that worries me a lot. And it starts with a philosophical joke. Think about poor old Jones. You know, Jones lost his job. His wife left him, his children got run over, his dog left him, and to top it all off, Jones doesn't even exist. Now, it's a joke, but there's also something tragic in it, because that's my deep worry about tragedy. My deep worry about the tragicness of our lives is that we don't even exist. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, of course, my body exists. I exist, right, in that sense, if you just take it this physical object here, but I'm wondering if there's any me really there. It's related to Chris's point. Chris talked about the contingency, that everything is formed.
Well, what do you mean? I don't understand what you mean. You have to clarify that a bit.
You know, Beckett says it wonderfully. Did I ever say I to myself? And Beckett and people like Nietzsche raise this question of what it is to say I to yourself, what it is to really have an I. The way Nietzsche put it is, most people are just members of the herd. They don't really have a right to say I to themselves. They're just a reflection of currents around them. And I think that's a deep worry. That's what I see the tragedy of my life. I say, do I really exist? Yeah, this body is here, but does it add up to a whole? Does it add up to anything?
Maybe I could develop or just respond to that, because, I mean, my own view, which I think is not a view very widely accepted in philosophy, is that fundamentally the self cannot be understood, that fundamentally we are mysterious to
ourselves.
That's
the point I'm getting at.
It seems to me that actually what we do, we go through life always mistaking the unimportant things for the important things, and vice versa, that we live in a way extremely unclear about what it is we're doing, about the nature of the choices that we're making, and so on and so forth. And I think that does deliver a sense of the fundamental mystery of the self, which I think it can't be very well articulated in the discursive terms of philosophy, and comes through much more in literature, for
That's
example.
Exactly the point I want to take up, and it brings back to that point I mentioned earlier about tragedy. And it very much resonates with what Chris said about Macbeth. Macbeth existed, I mean, not as a real person, but as a real character. Mm. He's got a definite character. And my worry is, whether for good or for evil, I don't exist in the way Macbeth exists.
You haven't got a well-defined character. But,
So what?
I mean, it's like, you do exist as a person having experiences, and you've got a family, and you've got, got a career, and,
But, there's a wonderful short story by Chekhov called A Boring Story, is anything but boring, and there's a central character in it, who, as I remember, I think is a professor at a university, so maybe it's apt. One of the interesting things about his life is he comes to the view that his life is meaningless, but it's not because he doesn't value things. He actually values lots of things, his students, his wife, and so on and so forth. But he has this feeling, and maybe this is close to what Ken is saying, he has this feeling that somehow it doesn't add up. Yeah. Because a very powerful thought that one might have about tragedy is the sense that nothing has any value. But I think there's another, and that may be one form of it, but another form is things have value, but somehow it doesn't fit together. Somehow it's going nowhere. Somehow it kind of remains fragmented. And I think, and that would be, I suppose, a deeply tragic condition. I guess that, Ken, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
Things are valuable, but how does it fit together? Where's the scheme? Where's the telos?
Okay. Well, finally, I just want to ask Simon, do all cultures have a sense of tragedy, or are some cultures more stoical or accepting of life than others, do you think?
I don't know why you ask these easy questions at the end.
Yeah.
Well, the short answer is I really can't answer that question, but do all cultures have a sense of tragedy?
Yeah, do you think?
If I guessed, and I don't know the answer to the question, I would say yes, all cultures do have a sense of tragedy, perhaps, in a sense for the reason that I think tragedy is inevitable, that we are always going to have conflicts between our deepest desires and the world in which we find ourselves, and possibly between those desires themselves. They might have different desires, they might have different forms of meaning, and they might even have a different requirement about whether they want to seek an overall meaning in life, i.e. their life adding up to something, to which Chris and Ken just referred. But regardless of that, I think there will always be fundamental conflicts between human desire and the world.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe a last question we've got time for. One of the collateral implications of Darwinism is the idea that nature sanctions any behaviour expedient for long-term survival and reproduction. That is to say, natural selection tells us that the universe itself is amoral. Could we ever really align our thinking to a reality blind to suffering and evil? Or will some things always be morally repugnant to us?
Well, I'd be inclined to say some things will always be morally repugnant to us, or at any rate repugnant to us, because I think that it's true that human beings are valuing creatures. I think it's just an inevitable part of the way we are that things appeal to us, other things repel us, we make judgments about their value. That seems to me inevitable.
So from your point of view, tragedy is inevitable.
The further question is whether it is about the change in that, because one might agree, even if one agreed with that previous point, it can certainly be the case that different people value in different kinds of ways, and the question would be whether one could end up in a situation of what you describe with nihilism. In my view, I think that's impossible, but I think values can change enormously.
Well, it's not nihilism, it's just a reflection of the way nature is according to the current paradigm of how the world is, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I think a lot of that Darwinism and neo-Darwinism is extremely optimistic about, you know, it's a kind of very relaxed naturalism, okay. Which I think is, my own view, is implausible, and the reason is all of the reasons we've been talking about this evening, actually.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we're going to have to end there. Anybody got any projects or anything they want to plug?
Well, only that I'm writing a book on tragedy at the moment.
So. Okay, and Simon's book on love came out a few months ago, so please go and buy that.
There's plenty of tragedy there, yeah.
Yeah, and it goes into tragedy. Any books or projects, Ken?
Well, I make it a habit always to plug Simon's book on Nietzsche, which is one of my absolute favourite books on Nietzsche.
Well, there you go. And I've got a couple of books, The Meta-Revolution and Love, Solitude and Destruction, available online. Yeah, if you go to Grant Bartley at Facebook, I'll give you signs to them. And we're going to... This is the Philosophy Now radio show. We've been talking about tragedy, and we're going to end with a bit of Dreams Made Flesh.